Thank you, Robert. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great honor to be in your midst today. Still, I cannot but wonder, why am I here? Is it because of my path-breaking work in the philosophical foundations of game theory or my book on the global crisis? No, of course not. It's because the Euro crisis has promoted me from a run-of-the-mill academic to a renowned Greek economist. A very dubious promotion, I may add. But such is this crisis that the marginal, quite unexpectedly, is propelled, thrusted upon the center of things. Take my country, Greece. Confined to the margins of the European map and the European economy for centuries, over the last 3 years, Greece has been making the global headlines. It is quite absurd. If the Northern Territory had the capacity, through some crisis, to bring down with it the Australian Commonwealth, that would be a sign that not that there is something wrong with the Northern Territory economy, but that there is something profoundly remiss with the Australian system of governance. Catherine the Great once said that if you can't be a good example, you should become a horrible warning. Well, ladies and gentlemen, might ask this fine warning is to be a Greek bearing not gifts, but a hideous warning. When the GFC struck in 2008, the GFC is, by the way, what the Australians call the credit crunch, we entered not some recession we had to have, as Keating once said, but our generation's global winter of discontent, our very own postmodern Great Depression. It may not feel like a depression outside here on the streets of Melbourne, but scratch the surface everywhere around the planet, and what you will find is justified uncertainty, legitimate insecurity, and potential insolvency. Can we expect the combined efforts of our central banks, quantitative easing programs, to help? At the very best, it will provide palliative care to a world in urgent need of a cure. A cure for what? A cure for what I term the twin peaks problem that follows a financial sector implosion like that of 1929 or of 2008. The first peak that emerges after such a financial implosion is that of a massive unserviceable debt and irretrievable banking losses. The second peak that emerges at the very same time is an equally mountainous one, and it comprises idle savings too terrorized to find themselves into productive medium and long-term investments. The solution surely requires the mobilization of the idle savings to produce the income which is necessary to repay the debts. Markets cannot do this once caught up in a terrible equilibrium of fear, which is aggravated by universal austerity across the board and only mildly cajoled by monetary easing. Can we find a solution by which to avoid and overcome this global slump? Of course we can. We did so twice after the Second World War. We did this in 1944 at the Bretton Woods Conference and again in the 1970s. Both solutions involved a mechanism for recycling surpluses into the deficit regions and sectors of the world. If our world is currently in a state of pronounced bewilderment, it is because no replacement has been found for the surplus recycling mechanism that expired with the GFC in 2008, when the United States lost its capacity to use its own deficits in order to recycle other people's surpluses. Which brings me to the Eurozone. It was built on the presumption that America's recycling of other people's surpluses would continue to provide adequate demand for net exporters like Germany. Thus, no endogenous surplus recycling mechanism was built into the Eurozone. So for 8 years, from 2000 onwards, the Eurozone resembled a fine riverboat on a calm ocean. But when America's recycling powers suddenly gave way in 2008, the seas turned stormy and the pretty European riverboat began to take water in. Thus, our modern Greco-European tragedy began. Instead of treating our systemic euro crisis systematically, the core began pointing moralizing fingers at the European periphery. Instead of concentrating on a systemic crisis, Europe concentrated on lending more money to insolvent states so they could lend more money to insolvent banks on conditions of harsh austerity that shrank the national income from which the old and the new debts would have to be repaid. Bailouts are being funded in Europe now by CDO-like bonds that contain within their design the very negative domino effect which causes more European banks and states to fail sequentially. In short, a dreadful monetary design was defended by toxic remedies. For 3 years now, Europe's response to the realization, to the discovery that it had created a monster, is an all-out assault on rationality. Almost in a bid to defy my hosts today, you may have noticed that I've said nothing about Greece so far. The reason is that there is very little to say about Greece. Greece was the flimsiest, most corrupt, least entrepreneurial part of the Eurozone. This is why it was the first domino to fall. It is not an explanation of the domino effect, however. Europe would be in the same state even if Greece was not part of the Eurozone. Nonetheless, Greece, however insignificant it might be, reminds us of how quickly a recession can turn into a full-fledged depression. It reminds us of Britain's and Australia's predicament between the world wars when they sought to stay within the gold standard by imposing self-defeating austerity upon their people. It also reminds us that when a financial crisis cripples an international currency union, the first thing that happens is the currency union disintegrates, and very soon after that, we end up with real Nazis in parliament. Greece has already undergone the greatest fiscal squeeze ever attempted in economic history. It is now being fiscally waterboarded to accept new austerity measures that everyone knows that they will drive the Greek economy further into the ground, ensuring that we will not be able to repay our debts to our partners. So, why this madness? Why is Europe doing this? Because, ladies and gentlemen, the alternative would be for its elites to come clean and to confess that they built the Eurozone on flimsy foundations. In her final parliamentary speech as Prime Minister, Mrs. Thatcher famously said about the Eurozone, and I quote, "It's all politics. Who controls interest rates is political. A single currency is about the politics of Europe." Hear, hear, I say. And you know, when a Greek left-wing economist quotes and misses Mrs. Thatcher, the world is in deep crisis. Where Mrs. Thatcher was wrong was in her belief that behind the Eurozone's foundation there was some secret agenda by Europe's elites to bring about a federation. Exhibit A, that they do not have such an agenda, is the current banking union debacle. Everyone knows a banking union is a prerequisite for stopping Italy's and Spain's descent into aggression vortex. And yet Germany, throughout the summer months, the northern summer months, has been single-mindedly working to wreck in practice the banking union which it agreed to in June. No, ladies and gentlemen, all talk of a federal agenda is bogus. As the Cambridge economist Nicholas Kaldor had presciently predicted in the 1970s, an attempt to create a flimsy currency union in Europe would not be the first step towards a federal Europe, but it would be the first step towards Europe's deconstruction. So what should we do? Europe is now the laboratory of our global, collective, common future. We should never have created this Europe. But given that we have, Europe has a moral responsibility to its people and to the rest of the world to fix it. Without the treaty changes, the fiscal pacts, and the Ponzi austerity programs which defy economic logic. Technically, we can achieve this within weeks. But as Mrs. Thatcher might have said today after consulting with Bill Clinton, it's the politics, stupid. If we fail as Europeans, Europe will have inflicted mass pain on the rest of the planet for a third time in 100 years. And then you will all become Greeks too, but not in the benign sense of sharing a love for Homer, for Thucydides, and for Sophocles. Thank you.
sociologist that has been through the greatest austerity program the world has seen, and now it's going to go war. But he does warn us that if Europe fails, then we'll all be embraced for the third time in 100 years in a major crisis. Against that background, we come to Italy. And Sandro, continue your addresses. I might add that I've asked each of the speakers to only speak for 8 minutes, and then we'll have our discussion after that. Sandro, over to you.
Well, I would be more down to earth than my colleague, and I will give you a more basic view, and I will give you a view in which reform, institutional reforms in individual countries, fiscal consolidation, will bring about after a recession in the next years, in the current year and then possibly in the next year, a better equilibrium situation. So maybe is less flamboyant than my dear colleague view, but there are some basic points that may be on my which support my view. So, everybody knows that, everybody agrees by now that there were some weaknesses in the design of EU. I will not go deep on this. The strongest part of the design, of the original design, were the rules in theory. In fact, they proved to be rather inadequate. But this was not a flaw in the original design. What was really a flaw in the original design was the idea that macroeconomic convergence would come about without making any effort at the European level, and that imbalance would not emerge in the individual countries. And then everybody knows there were no procedures for managing sovereign crisis, systemic bank crisis, and the global financial supervision of the European level, which it was clearly the same. My point is that certainly the European governance reform was very slow, and it was somewhat chaotic, but I argue that in the end, if you look at what has been done, a lot of things have been done, and the process